baby is born without prejudice. He has a fresh new mind. He must be taught to hate. This is Bob Considine. You're listening to the opening program of our new series, Image Minorities. A newborn baby may grow up to love his fellow man or to hate. A child's playmates today may be barred from his fraternity tomorrow. The soldier on the next cot may not be able to live in the house next door. But prejudice can explode in violence, too. We remember with shame the race riots in Detroit and Chicago's Trumbull Park. Professor Gordon Allport of Harvard is the country's leading authority on prejudice and discrimination. Professor Allport, how does that baby we were talking about just a moment ago, how does he grow up to be a man who hates? How does it all begin?
Well, we're beginning to learn a good deal about childhood and the development of prejudice. It's very hard to build our prejudices into children. Children have no sense of animosity until it's gradually built in at 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And by the time they're 12, they probably have all of the adult prejudices common to their group.
What is the reason for prejudice?
There are very many reasons for prejudice. You can't reduce it to a simple thing. I would say that one of the main reasons is the need of a prejudiced person. He lives a life of exclusion. His mind goes something like this. I am feeling a bit insecure in this world, and I don't like to be threatened by outsiders, so I will be against all immigration and all refugees. And then he says, I'll get rid of all Negroes, 10 or 13 million of them, by considering them all as a group to be lazy and dependable and so on. And then he gets rid of 40, 50 million Catholics by saying, oh, they're just superstitious. They only know what the priest tells them. And then he gets rid of 4 or 5 million Jews by saying, well, they'll skin you alive if you let them. And then he gets rid of, let's say, all Democrats and labor by saying that they are just out for themselves and are radical. And then, of course, he can get rid of all teachers and intellectuals along with all other communists, as he says, and pretty soon there's nobody left for him to worry about excepting his own group on suburban heights, and he can destroy them one by one through gossip. Now, what I'm saying is that certain people seem to have an economy of life that is based on exclusion and hate. They just can't relax and accept people for what they are, but they must build up themselves, build up their own egos by running down all these many, many groups that comprise America. Now, that is a common pattern that explains prejudice, but let me remind you that discrimination is another matter.
Do you think it's necessary to make a distinction between prejudice and discrimination?
Yes, I think it's important to distinguish between discrimination and prejudice. Discrimination is the act of excluding people from some privilege that they desire. For example, from voting or good housing or schooling, from churches, from jobs, from hotels and recreation areas. All of those forms of discrimination have been and are practiced. Let me point out that legal action, the Supreme Court and its rulings, which since 1927 have been uniformly against discriminative practices, those rulings have to do only with discrimination. They simply say, in America, we do not discriminate. Your feelings can take care of themselves. And so I think it's important for us to realize that legal court action is not aimed at prejudice at all, but rather at discrimination. Now, of course, there is a relation. The relation is that if we stop discriminating, if we do admit children on equal basis to our schools, the hope is and the probability is that in time prejudice will lessen. Because when we have equal contact with our minority groups, we generally find that they're pretty decent people and our feelings of hostility lessen. That's the argument for attacking our great national problem at the level of discrimination, legally. But now, prejudice also enters our picture.
How would you define prejudice?
Well, prejudice really can be defined very simply. St. Thomas Aquinas once said that prejudice is a matter of thinking ill of others without sufficient warrant. Thinking ill of others without sufficient warrant is what we mean by the kinds of prejudice we encounter in anti-Negro feeling, anti-Semitism, or anti-Catholicism, or whatnot. When people give a completely false reason for their views, which is overgeneralization. You can't say anything about any group that is always true, excepting the most slender facts. You can't say anything about all Jews that is true, excepting that they belong to a group that are descended from Jews, unless they happen to be converts. Or you can't say anything about Negroes, excepting that they probably have some ancestry from Africa. There's nothing else that is true about all Negroes. Therefore, when one has a negative attitude toward Negroes because they are, we say, lazy, superstitious, run-down property values, it is prejudice, because the statement is thinking ill of others without sufficient warrant.
Thinking ill of others without sufficient warrant, that is prejudice. Prejudice can sometimes show itself in just a raised eyebrow, a tone of voice, but at other times prejudice erupts in uglier ways. Here's Frank London Brown, the author of Trumbull Park, a book based on his own experience when he moved to the Federal Housing Project in Trumbull Park, Chicago.
We applied and were accepted by the Housing Authority and were assigned to the Trumbull Park homes. My wife, Evelyn, and my, at the time, my two daughters, Deborah and Cheryl, my wife, my third daughter was on the way at the time. When I went there and saw the antagonism and saw the mobs in the streets and recognized the attitude of the police, I, at the same time, happened to notice an article in the Chicago Daily News which cited two groups as being those primarily responsible for the disturbances out there. And they listed the name of the president of the group. I contacted the president of this group and asked for an appointment during which we could sit down and discuss what it was that was angering everybody and to attempt to peaceably settle the matter. We talked, and the conclusion of that conversation, which had been much of a mystery for a long time, was no mystery at all. The president said that he would be very happy to solve the problem by having the Negroes move out of the project and to recognize that it had been a mistake for them to move in the first place. Well, this closed the door on any peaceable negotiation with the official heads of the antagonistic groups in the area. After that, it was a question of simply taking what they had to put out. Now, they had at one time a little technique of igniting something like one very potent and very loud explosive kind of rocket per minute, or possibly every 2 minutes. So for hour after hour, we would find ourselves subjected to a noise barrage that was of sufficient strength to shake the very house. In addition to that, when we walked to the store, and we had to go to the store to buy food, we were frequently confronted with mobs that shoved us and pushed us around, and frequently we attempted to defend ourselves, and not too infrequently were arrested as a result. I spent one very interesting night in jail as the result of a difficulty with them.
Did the Negroes get together and try to decide what to do?
We decided to get together. We met frequently. At one time, we met every night, and then after a while, every week. And at these meetings, we talked about what we could do to relieve the tension that had been exerted against us. We talked about the thing that I had tried, talking to the head of the thing, and that did no good. And before we could talk about other steps to take with regard to the mob, we found ourselves confronted with a series of problems with the police themselves. In the first place, it was clear to us that we were being observed in terms of what we were going to do to the mob rather than protect it in light of what the mob had and potentially would do to us. The next hurdle with the police, again, was having to ride in a paddy wagon, a big truck, to and from work, to and from the grocery stores. As a matter of fact, when the women there became pregnant and had to go to the hospital, they had to ride in this truck to and from the hospital even. So we refused after a while to ride in the trucks, and they agreed to let us ride in the squad cars. But then we became dissatisfied with that because the police cars became a symbol of our own fearfulness, and the crowds would stand on the street and point at us and say, "You'd better not walk these streets," and jeer and all. So finally, a few of us decided that in order to really fight for our rights as human beings, we would walk the streets. This was a crucial moment because we knew that by walking the streets, we would be faced with mobs which had by then attacked several policemen, had attacked several of us, and had indicated that they were very serious about doing damage to us. Some of the fellows wanted to carry guns. We knew that by carrying guns, again, we would be immediately subject to the attack of the police and would wind up either dead or in jail. And others of us wanted to walk without carrying guns, assuming that if we were killed, the result would be an enforcement of the law for the rest of us, and also assuming that the mobs themselves were too cowardly to kill us if we faced them straightforwardly. So we, two of us, decided to face the mob and walk. The others decided that if we got out alive, they would do it. And the day it happened, I was one of the fellows, and a man named named Joe Sneed was the other. And we walked out of the project without difficulty, but the word had gotten through the neighborhood that we had walked out instead of riding out. So when we came back from work, we were met by at least 4,000 people and almost an equal number of policemen. And they jeered and threw things at us and hit us. And finally, it got to a point where we threatened to beat up one guy that was really leading it. The police immediately enforced the law and stopped that. And we managed to get from the bus stop to our homes alive.
Did you get any sympathy or help from your white neighbors?
I can't forget one particular time. It wasn't one time as much as it was one event. There was one woman out there who lived right in the midst of the thing, and there were times when the plan had been to dynamite our houses and to assault us as we came in. They knew our schedules by then. And this woman used to sneak out of the project. She found out where I worked. I never found that out, how she found out, but she used to come to my job during the day to tell me what they were going to do to us when we got home that day. And she really did risk her life because some of the other white people in the project who wanted to be decent, well, in the area, had experienced such things as having their homes bombed, having their windows broken. The church out there was mysteriously burned after they agreed to let Negroes attend it. A garage was blown up. A tavern was blown up. So this woman really actually risked her life to warn us of the things that they were planning. I cannot say that this attitude was typical of the neighborhood, but there were more. There was one man who lived next door to Donald Howard who was subjected to much of what Howard was. Donald Howard was the first Negro family to move out there. And they broke out Howard's windows, and because this man visited Howard, they broke out his windows. So you saw twin houses, one occupied by a Negro and one occupied by a white person.
Two houses, side by side, one owned by a white man, one by a Negro, both with their windows smashed by the mob. Hate never stops at one house. Tumble Park is no longer the address of Frank London Brown. He moved. Image Minorities continues in just a moment.
That is the sound of American industry, the great mechanical giant that has led free men to victory in two terrible wars, and in the process has set the pace for mankind's emergence into the mysterious and promising age of the atom and space. Behind those sounds you've just heard, the engineer at the throttle of the locomotive, the truck driver, the tough-looking guy with a cigarette dangling from the side of his mouth as he operates a riveting machine, behind all those sounds are the people of America. The engineer might be a second-generation Irishman, the truck driver, a Negro whose father was an Alabama sharecropper. The riveter could be an American Indian. That's the human story of the industrial power of America, and that's an essential part of our story on Image Minorities, the story of the American melting pot and how we, all of us, help create the wonder of this modern age.
There have always been people who have considered others inferior to themselves. But it is really only within the past century that some attempted to surround this idea with a pseudo-scientific jargon. The weird doctrine of racism found its high priest in a hysterical demagogue who sent millions to their deaths.
Aus allen Gauen des Heidreichs hergerufen, die älteste Ostbarn des deutschen Volkes, sei von jetzt ab das jüngste Volk!
In his maniacal fury, he shouted about the superiority of the people he labeled the Aryan race. Echoing the voice of the master, Mussolini claimed that there existed in Italy a pure Italian race of Aryan Nordic type. What is race? That's the question we have for the distinguished psychologist, Dr. Otto Kleinberg of Columbia University. Dr. Kleinberg, what is race?
The question of how to define race is really a very complicated one. There probably is no other word in the English language that has been so abused as the word race. The word race is used correctly to refer to a group of common origin and common genetic characteristics. Well, so far so good. We would then be careful, of course, to distinguish the word race from words referring to nation. We would not refer to a German race then, because the Germans are obviously very mixed. We would never refer to a Jewish race, because the Jewish people have all kinds of physical characteristics. And even as far as Negroes are concerned, well, American Negroes, of course, in many instances are much more white genetically than they are Negro. Well, all of this is an indication of the difficulties in the concept of race. Some scientists have gone so far as to say we ought to throw the word out altogether. Well, for purposes of this discussion, I'm going to take it for granted that the word race cannot be eliminated. We're going to continue to use it. We can't help it, really. Then I would suggest let's try to use it correctly, namely to refer to groups of common origin and common physical type as determined by the common heredity.
Now, using this definition of race, Dr. Kleinberg, can we make any distinctions between races as to inferiority or superiority?
Now, a number of arguments have been used in order to bolster up the idea that we can speak of superior and inferior races. On the one hand, it has been suggested that there is a biological superiority and inferiority, that, for example, some racial groups are more primitive than others. Well, this, I think, can safely be thrown out entirely, because this, too, the notion of primitivity, depends on which criterion you use. For example, you can argue, well, the long arms of the Negro suggest a close resemblance to, let us say, pre-human ancestors, like the anthropoid apes. Well, that sounds logical. But the long legs of the Negro are very different from the length of leg in the anthropoid apes. In other words, in one criterion, they seem rather close to the apes. In another criterion, they seem very different. Take such a thing as the amount of hair on the body of the male. Well, in this respect, the white male is much closer to the anthropoid. Then would come the Negro, let us say, and then the Oriental or the American Indian with the least amount of hair on the body. Now, all of these factors taken together indicate that the notion of greater or lesser biological primitiveness depends, again, on the characteristic that you use. And if you look at all of the characteristics taken together, you cannot make a scientifically reputable case for the notion that any one racial group is more primitive biologically or more advanced biologically than any other.
Dr. Kleinberg, what about the intelligence tests in determining the basic intelligence of different groups?
Those who have had better economic opportunities do, on the average, get higher IQs than those who have not had such good opportunities. Now, therefore, when we deal with minorities, many of whom have had inferior opportunities for their own development, it becomes clear that we cannot safely interpret the results of intelligence tests as an indication of their inferiority. Now, most people don't realize that the minority group in the United States that obtains the lowest scores on the average in intelligence tests is not the American Negro, but the American Indian. And this is not too hard to understand if we remember that their culture, their way of living, before they took over some, at least, of the ways of the white man, were very, very different indeed, and they weren't prepared to pass our intelligence test in the same way as white children were. But there was one American Indian group which was discovered to have an intelligence quotient equal to, if not slightly superior, to that of the white children with whom they were compared. This group was the Osage Indians in Oklahoma, studied by Professor Rohrer, who at that time was professor at the University of Oklahoma. Now, why did the Osage Indians do so much better? Well, it so happened that after they were given a tract of land as a reservation, oil was discovered there. Now, that didn't make them all millionaires, because the oil royalties had to be divided among a number of owners. But it did result in the Osage Indians being able to raise the general economic level in which they lived, to improve their schools, to give their children a better education, to travel, to have in their homes all the conveniences that white people have, and sometimes even a little more. And as a consequence, I think we have a right to say that, as a consequence, their intelligence quotient moved up to a level equal to or slightly superior to that of the whites with whom they were by whom they were surrounded. And so I have sometimes suggested that all we need to do to raise the intelligence level of minority groups is to find oil on their land. That is to say, in other words, to give them the same opportunities that white children have. And if we give them those opportunities, I venture to predict that the differences in intelligence level, as measured by any of the tests that we have at our disposal, would in time disappear.
Perhaps someday, when the American dream does become reality for all, we'll be able to find out. Tonight on our opening program of Image Minorities, we've talked of the waves of immigration, of the nature of race and prejudice, of the meaning of the melting pot. But this is just a beginning. During the next 4 weeks, we'll explore the way of life, the problems, the contributions of the many groups that make up America. We shall get to know them better. Perhaps with this knowledge will come understanding. Perhaps we'll come to appreciate more the richness of the many backgrounds flowing together in the mainstream of American life. We'll hear the sounds of America. An Indian Sundance. Poles brought the polka with them, and like the Poles, it became American. The Italian Street Festival, so much a part of the life of Assisi or Sorrento, let's say, seems equally at home today in the streets of New Haven or Philadelphia. In a Spanish courtyard in New Mexico, the song comes from Old Mexico. Customs from everywhere, music from everywhere, people from everywhere. This is the story we'll tell on Image Minorities. It is fitting that tomorrow we begin our survey of peoples with the first immigrant to arrive in America, the Indian. Who is he? Where does he live? What does he believe? Where does he fit in the pattern of modern American life? The Indian himself will tell us.
The Navajo people are a very vigorous, and I should like to say ambitious people. The average age of the Navajo people is 23, and they live on the Navajo reservation, which has a size of about 16 million acres and is generally compared to the size of the state of West Virginia. The average income, I would say, is approximately $750 per family per year.
$16 million acres, roughly the size of the state of West Virginia. $750 per family per year. Typical? We'll find out tomorrow when we devote a full program to the Indian. We'll visit a school on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. Listen in on a protest meeting in the cool pine and lake country of the Menominee in Wisconsin. We'll ask the Indian how he feels about life in the big city. We'll hear from Indian authors, athletes, actors, dancers. Chat with people like Allie Reynolds, Lone Star Dietz, Maria Tallchief, and even with that most durable hero of the plains, Tonto. Tomorrow night at the same time, Image Minorities.
Comedy by Groucho Marx, Ernie Kovacs, and Ed Archie Gardner on Stardust tonight over most of these NBC stations.